agenda item 7, hydraulic project implementing bills 1579, briefing and public hearing. Morgan, Randy, and Pat, I guess. We have three staff members.
Good morning, Commissioner Carpenter, other commissioners. Morgan here. Can you see me and hear me all right? Okay. Well, you've got Randy and I, and the truth of the matter is that Randy is really the star of this show today, so I will make a brief introduction before turning it over to Randy, and I think she's going to walk you through the handout that we prepared for you today. As the title indicates, we're here again to talk with you about hydraulic project approval, civil compliance rules. As the title suggests, these implement significant portions of the governor's so-called ORCA PREA bill. You likely recall that when we spoke with you in February, we described a handful of changes that we were proposing to make to the staff proposal as a result of the public comment that we got in. Most of those changes were minor for clarity, and they did not change the substance of the rules. But one of those did, in fact, proposed to change the substance of the rules, and that was a request largely from the regulated community to provide some additional detail and clarity and transparency about how actual penalty amounts would be calculated for that portion of the rule. So as a result, we published a supplemental CR 102, and that's going to be the focus of the remarks today, is our briefing to you about the proposals that we are making about how to actually provide that transparency and clarity about how those penalties would be calculated. So I think without further ado, Randy, I'll pass it over to you.
Thank you, Morgan. Thank you, commissioners. As Morgan stated, when we met with you in late February at your conference call, we had received 9 comments and proposed actually 9 changes as a result. 8 of those were minor, and we discussed those in some detail with you on the conference call. We did end up making one change as a result of a comment that we got from Commissioner Thorburn on the description of the compliance program. Making it read less like guidance and more like rule, I think is how Commissioner Thorburn described it. We didn't have a lot of specificity on what the new penalty schedule would look like, and that was the major change that we needed to go out for and get an additional public comments on and file the CR 102 for. What I thought I'd do today is just walk you through the penalty schedule if there's no additional questions about those 8 minor changes, if that's agreeable. I don't see anybody raising a hand, so I'm going to go share my screen here.
Hearing no objection.
Okay. So hopefully you can see my screen okay. The resolution's okay.
Looks good.
Okay. So what we did for the penalty schedule is we had a concept when we came to you of looking at what the other resource agencies had done for the penalty schedule. So we looked at their statutes, rules, and for DNR and ecology, we actually looked at some manuals too. And what we came up with was a penalty schedule that really was modeled after DNR forest practices penalty schedule with one kind of big exception that I'll talk about in a few minutes. What we went with was a base penalty plus a penalty for what's called special considerations. And in the statute, there's considerations that are listed for previous violation history, kind of severity and repairability of the damage, the intent and the cooperation. And so those are the special considerations. So for the base penalty, we really modeled this after the DNR forest practices. Some We have three, basically, items that would result in a $2,000 base penalty. That's conducting a hydraulic project without a valid HPA. If you willfully misrepresent information on your HPA application, or there's a significant deviation from your HPA that adversely affects fish life. So those are the three that would result in a $2,000 base penalty. And then all others would be a $500 base penalty. And this base penalty plus the special considerations would be the total penalty for the violation. So just going to walk down here. Is there any questions about the base penalty before I move on? Okay. All right. So in the rules, we had a description of what these special considerations are, and that description remains. But what we did to address the comments from the regulated community is we assigned some points to the descriptions. So the points for previous violation history and severity and repairability are higher than the points that can be assigned for the intent and cooperation. And this is also similar to what DNR Forest Practices has done. There's a total of 14 points that you can get from this assessment. And I'll just walk through maybe the severity and repairability of impacts to kind of describe how this would work. So something that would receive 0 points would be something like a single-family residence dock that was constructed on a lake. Well, we don't have any anadromous fish. It's a warm water fish lake, and that was done without an HPA. But the structure itself would have complied with the hydraulic code standards, and it would have complied with an HPA had we issued one for the project. So that would be an example of something that wouldn't get points assessed for severity and repairability. For 2 points, an example would be that a culvert was started late and has run beyond the authorized work time. The project proponent didn't ask for a modification of the HPA, and as a result, there was the bypass, because it wasn't passable, blocked adult migrating salmon for a week from moving upstream to spawning grounds. So that could be an example of kind of the 2-point range. And that's an impact, you know, that only lasted for the duration of the construction activity. For 4 points, example would be a beaver dam removed without a permit. The dam impounded a wetland that provided important coho rearing habitat. During the removal, the water level dropped quickly, stranding fish and resulting in a fish kill. In addition, the wetland habitat no longer exists and is a major loss of rearing habitat for this particular stream system. So that would be an example of a violation that will last beyond the construction activity. So what we do is, again, this is a total of 14 points here. Where we deviated from the DNR forest practices example is how we then calculate the total penalty. Basically, what DNR has done is they've taken the base penalty and used it as a multiplier. So if you had a violation that had a $2,000 base penalty, you would only need 4 points in order to get to the $10,000 maximum penalty per day. Or I'm sorry, not per day, per violation. That was a big faux pas. and so what we did instead is we looked at ecology. Ecology has a matrix, and we chose to use the base penalty and add the point dollar amounts to it instead of using it as a multiplier. Sorry. So what this means is, I'll just give you some examples. I'll just go down here to the examples.
Randy, would it be all right if I added to that a little bit?
Sure.
I apologize if you were going to cover this, but we felt like using the base penalty as a multiplier because it got to higher penalty amounts faster, we felt like that was often not appropriate given that so many of the clientele, nearly half or so, who get HPAs in a given year are single family residences, sort of what we call the mom and pop applicants, and that quick escalation to higher penalty levels didn't seem commensurate with that customer base as well as the types of violations that we're seeing. And so what Randy's going to walk through is we felt a better reflection of a reasonable approach to address the types of violations, customers, and range that we see of violations.
Yeah, so in the first scenario, this would be a violator that had more than one documented violation in the last 5 years. There's an extensive or significant adverse impacts that last beyond the construction activity, so that's the 4-point maximum. The violation was foreseeable and no precautions were taken, and the violator did not report the violation or did not cooperate with department staff. So in this case, that would be 10 points. And because the 10 points is $10,000, which is our maximum that we're proposing in our rules per violation, even with the base penalty, it would still be $10,000. Under DNR's scenario, using a multiplier of the $500, for example, well, in this case, it wouldn't be 500, but if it was a 10-point project and it was multiplied by 500, that would only be a $5,000 penalty, and something this severe, we felt is actually deserving of a higher penalty amount as well. So that's another reason why we deviated from DNR's model and kind of went more with this matrix. So basically, if you have a $2,000 base penalty, you'd have to get 8 points to be at the max instead of 4 for DNR. But we also get to, with DNR's model, you would never get to $10,000. The most you could ever get to would be $7,500 for a $500 base penalty. This is probably more going to be kind of a more common scenario where a violator doesn't have any previous violation history. There's adverse impacts to fish life, but it's minor, and it doesn't extend beyond the duration of the construction activity. The violation wasn't foreseeable, and the violator did not report the violation, or they did not cooperate with department staff. It'd be more likely that they wouldn't report it. So in this case, the consideration points would give you a $3,000 penalty amount. That would be added to the base penalty of $500. And so the total penalty for that violation would be $3,500. So that's how that works. I know that's kind of a, is there any questions about that I can answer?
Question?
Commissioner McKaysen.
Yeah, thank you. Question on the base penalty. In the handout, it seems to suggest that the base penalty is $2,000, period. Last example, you have a base of $500. Why mm-hmm. would that not be $2,000?
So in this second scenario?
Yes, in that.
Yeah. So to be $2,000, so in this case, in the second scenario, we're assuming that the violator had an HPA, and there wasn't a significant deviation from the HPA, although there was a deviation, but it wasn't significant. So the $2,000 in this base penalty in this case wouldn't apply. It only applies for those three specific types of work. So the conducting without an HPA, if they if they basically misrepresent information or were untruthful in their application, or there was a significant deviation, that would be a $2,000 base penalty if that occurred.
Okay, so yes. It's either $500 or $2,000. There's no in betweens on that.
That's true. Yes, that's correct.
If I may, Commissioner Baker. Commissioner Baker, did you have your hand up?
Sorry, I was muted. My question isn't about the arithmetic of calculating the permits. It's about the applicability of these penalties to groups in the state. And my specific question is whether will this penalty schedule apply to those who are engaging in motorized suction dredge mining?
Yes, it'll apply to anybody that's doing a hydraulic project in the state, so that would include folks that are doing motorized mining.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner McKay, do you have another question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has to do with the top end of $10,000, or maybe it's $12,000, I'm not sure.
It's 10.
It's 10, okay.
Okay, yeah.
So if there's a real grievous, terrible situation here where somebody completely violates something and scrapes out a whole bunch of gravel out of the river right where the chum salmon have just spawned, and the amount of fish resources that are lost in that one event is more than $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an exception for those kind of grievous problems, or in that situation even then, or another one where there's a developer who's done something really bad in a subdivision? Anyway, is there some other spot for these great big problems, or is it 10,000 no matter how bad it is as a max?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And another thing to keep in mind is these penalties go into the state general fund, so none of this money goes to restoration of the damage that was done. So the intent of the penalties is to be a deterrent. I think in the situation that you described, Commissioner McIsaac, what I would recommend in that case is that we would go with criminal prosecution, so we could get restitution and we could get damage repaired that was done, as, you know, in those really egregious situations, rather than using the civil tool.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
If I could have a follow up to Commissioner McIsaac's question and Commissioner Baker, for that matter. What if you had a problem individual or company, and they had three violations in 1 year or 2 years? Is there three strikes you're out, or something more severe to try and curtail this problem? I mean, it boils down to an economic opportunity for some of these suction dredge miner people. We're not trying to put them out of business, but we don't want them to put us out of business either.
Right. So we do have... we do have another tool that was given to us in this legislation, which is called an intent to disapprove an HPA application. And so if somebody has had violations, or, well, if they have outstanding orders or notices, or they haven't paid their civil penalties, we can actually deny them an HPA until they basically take care of their, you know, what's in arrears and come into compliance.
Randy, if it's sole proprietorship or a small company, I mean, they can go, you know, apply for and get a new DBA in a matter of a couple of days. And how would we track that?
Good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to look into that. You know, I guess it would depend if the violation was tied to the company or is tied to the, you know, the owner of the company.
If I remember right, I'm trying not to talk too much. I understand my sound is not very good. But if I remember right, that part of the bill lets us look for who the violator was. Was it the landowner? Mm-hmm. Was it the company? Was it another contractor? So that flexibility is there. I think the other reality is that this is a very new tool to us, so there's a lot we don't know about how it will work. I think our intent would be to try to keep the restrictions tied as closely as possible to the person or group that was responsible for those other violations.
The other option too, you know, if you have a repeat violator like that, is to do the criminal prosecution. And I actually had a case where I had a person that violated like four times in a year, and as part of the settlement in the court, they weren't allowed to do any hydraulic projects for 2 years. So, you know, there's some other tools that we could always talk with enforcement about too. It might
Thank
be
you.
More appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Chair Carpenter, if I may, just briefly.
Yeah, Joe.
Just to reiterate Randy's statements about criminal enforcement, the criminal enforcement angle for HPA violations preexisted this recent legislation, which opened up the doors for the civil enforcement. So the civil enforcement was the legislature's effort to allow more of an educational based, you know, leading the horse to the water effort to gain compliance, as opposed to only having the strict hammer of a criminal case against someone. Fish and Wildlife has been good on pursuing the criminal cases. The Attorney General's office itself actually prosecuted one of those cases for Fish and Wildlife, where there was an individual who just blatantly bulldozed the Tahuya River on the Kitsap Peninsula, and our office brought that case and did get a criminal conviction against a bad actor who blatantly defied any of these restrictions and did significant modification to a natural river course. So, you know, they're spot on. That has always existed as authority, and it continues to remain available to the agency.
Thank you for the explanation, Joe.
I'm not sure if there's no other questions. I'm not sure if there's public signed up to testify on this or not.
I don't have any information yet that tells me there are or how many there are. Tess, would you or Melissa?
Yeah, I think at this time, I know we have at least one person, Rob Crebo, who does want to say something, and I'm also just going to open it up as well. We are going to collect some public testimony using the raise the hand feature on Zoom. So if you dialed in on your phone to raise your hand, you can press *9, and then we'll be unmuting folks, similar to how we did earlier this morning. And if you're on the computer, look for that raise hand icon. And if it's okay with you, Larry, I'll go ahead and unmute Rob and get us started.
That'd be great. Thank you. He already knows the 3-minute rule. I don't have to indoctrinate him. So.
I will do my best to behave. Good morning, afternoon, members of the commission, Chair Carpenter and WDFW staff. This is Rob Crable, Northwest Representative from Defenders of Wildlife, calling from sunny South Tacoma this morning. I want to start off by thanking all of you for continuing to make these public meetings accessible to the public during this time of COVID-19. I've expressed this to several department staff. I've really appreciated the department's response to this crisis and so quickly moving to these remote access points. So just thank you for that. My comments will be brief. I'm mostly just echoing some of the written comments that I submitted to the commission and to Randy yesterday on behalf of the Orca Salmon Alliance, which is a group of 16 organizations ranging from small local ones to large national groups like Defenders of Wildlife. We support these rules as written. We worked really hard to pass SHB 1579 last year, which these rules seek to codify some of the recommendations from that legislation. And we also really appreciate the department's focus on deterring and voluntary compliance before moving into more of those strict civil penalties. We think that that's a really great way to go about with getting more folks to comply with these rules. And as you all know, this is an issue that defenders and the Orca Salmon Alliance are particularly concerned about, given the importance of nearshore and marine habitat for both juvenile Chinook and the forage fish that adult Chinook will predate on as they come back to spawn. The more that we can protect this habitat type, the further we can advance our southern resident orca recovery efforts and make sure that we prevent the extinction of this very important species. The one thing that I would recommend be added on to this is, as scientists, we are always looking for ways to adaptively manage. And I think it would be important for the department to do some sort of monitoring of these rules to make sure that the civil penalties that are put in place are actually performing the deterrent that they were intended to perform. There's some concerns that some of the larger applicants may be able to roll some of these fees into their standard costs of doing business. So it would just be important to include some of those adaptive management and monitoring efforts. But by and large, very happy with this, very supportive of it, and we urge the adoption of these rules.
Rob, thank you for your testimony. Any questions of Rob? Hearing none, thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we've got Nora Nickum and Tina Whitman, you're on deck.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Carpenter, Commissions, and WDFW staff. My name is Nora Nickum, and I'm commenting on behalf of the Seattle Aquarium. The Seattle Aquarium strongly supports the proposed hydraulic code rules as they are written. These rules are vital for protecting forage fish, salmon, and orcas. Healthy nearshore habitat that supports these and other species is becoming increasingly scarce, and improving WDFW's civil enforcement authority so it can consistently and firmly apply the hydraulic code will really help restore natural ecological processes that create and support this nearshore habitat. And echoing Rob's point, we also wanted to ask WDFW to be sure to carefully monitor these rules as they are implemented to make sure they're working as intended. So thank you for the opportunity to comment, and we strongly urge the Commission to adopt the proposed rules.
Nora, thank you for your comments. Any questions of Nora? Hearing none, thank you very much. Next, please.
All right, Tina Whitman. And Tina, yep, there you go.
Yeah, I just unmuted. Thank you, Tina Whitman, Friends of the San Juans. I also am provided written testimony, but I'm here today to support the hydraulic code rule amendments. I think they're long overdue, and I'm fully supported by the science and also the public interest. I manage shoreline habitat restoration research and protection projects in the San Juan since 2002, so we really see a lot of what's going on the shorelines. And we certainly all, I think, could agree that improved regulatory effectiveness is going to be an essential component of salmon recovery, and also that our current regulatory framework is failing in many ways to stop the incremental and cumulative impacts to our shorelines that are supporting our marine food webs. I think it's important to note that the understanding of the negative impacts of shoreline armoring and also the feasible alternatives that exist and the many programs that exist to help property owners are all things that are really new since this residential exemption was originally authorized. The landscape has really changed, and I think I recommend or I appreciate that this code is update is really acknowledging, you know, that our technical and social systems have changed. I also think it's so important for the state to provide consistent leadership on this issue, especially for small or rural communities with counties that lack the technical or financial resources. We're really left holding the line against new armoring or enforcement actions. So these updates will really help address that gap. And I think it's also important just to note that Healthy Shorelines is not just supporting fish and wildlife, it's supporting our communities and our economies. The shorelines are, all, of course, providing rearing habitat for juvenile Chinook salmon, supporting our orca, but our shorelines are also the foundation of our economy, our human economy. So again, I'm just here to talk in support of these code rules that reflect scientific understanding and also our public opinion, and I really encourage you to adopt these rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Tina, for your comments. Any questions of Tina this morning, this afternoon now? Thank you. What's next, Tess?
I don't see any other members of the public with their hand raised. That's star 9 on the phone or the hand raise icon. So if we don't see anyone in the next moment, then we'll be able to move forward.
And I don't see any hands up from the commission, so I think we're about to put a wrap. Margan and Randy, thank you very much for your work. And look forward to hearing the next steps.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll see you on the 24th with the plan is to come back on the 24th and ask for your vote on this. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we will move.